The scouts continue along the group, passing Elian by. It seems he was right about his so-called immunity. Either Elian's sway extends far beyond his own Mydassan kingdom, or Queen Galina of Idilio really does have a weakness for pirates. A scout approaches me and gestures for me to hold out my arms. He towers over me by at least 2 heads, with a patchy orange beard that trickles down to his neck. His skin is fishbone white, a less immaculate version of my own, or what it once was before my mother's curse. I still haven't seen my new self. I would rather stay blind to how humanity has tarnished a face that once sunk ships. The scout takes a step closer, and I smell stale smoke on his uniform. "Touch me," I tell him, "and I will break every one of your fingers." His eyes roam over my body, taking note of how the wrinkled white dress clings awkwardly to my sharpened shoulders. He must decide that I don't pose much of a threat, because he quickly grabs my arms and spreads them out like wings. I use his disregard to my advantage, confident that even without my strength, I'm still deadly. I may not have my fins or even my voice, but I am my mother's daughter. I am the most murderous creature in the 100 kingdoms. I twist my outstretched arm back underneath the scout's hands and pull on his wrist, then angle my elbow up and make to crack it across his smug face. When I move, there's a satisfying thump, but it's not the sound of bone crunching. It's the sound of me being flung to the ground. The guard has snatched my arm and thrown me with enough force for my elbow to scrape against the gravel. The pain sears across my skin, and I feel fury like never before. I could have killed him with one hand if this was the ocean. One song. Yet now I'm cowering as my arm throbs under my weight. How can I expect to take down a trained siren killer when I can't handle one pitiful guard? I glare, and the scout moves his hand to his hip, half pulling his sword from his belt. His comrades reach for pistols. I can see the anger in their eyes as they think about repaying me for trying to attack one of their own. But they don't draw. Instead, they look to the prince. Elian stares back with an indifferent expression. He's sitting on the counter of the scout station, one leg hoisted onto the wooden varnish, knee resting in the crook of his elbow. In one hand, he holds an apple the color of rose blossoms. "So much for a warm welcome," he says and hops down from the counter. The scout wipes his nose with the back of his hand. "She tried to hit me," he snarls. Elian takes a bite from the apple. "She also threatened to break your fingers," he says. "You should grab her again and find out if she was bluffing."
"I was just trying to search for weapons. We need to check everyone coming into the kingdom. It's law."
"Not everyone." As Elian moves his hand back to his waist, there's a flash of the knife he never seems to let out of his sight. If the guards didn't notice it before, they have now. And it's obvious that's exactly what Elian wants. The scout wavers.
"She could be hiding a weapon," he argues,
but there's less conviction in his voice.
"Right."
Elian nods.
"So many places she could have stashed it."
He turns to me and holds out his hand.
"Give up that crossbow you've got under your skirt and they'll let you off with a slap on the wrist."
His voice is deadpan, and when I only glare in response, Elian turns back to the scout and throws his arms up like I'm being difficult.
"You'll just have to throw her in the dungeons,"
Kai says, appearing by Elian's side. I'm not entirely sure if he's joking.
She's clearly part of some elite smuggling ring.
Elian turns to him and gasps, placing a hand to his heart.
"Gods,"
he says, lowering his voice to a conspiratorial whisper.
"What if she's a pirate?"
Kai snorts, and after a moment I realize that I'm smiling too.
I can't remember the last time I truly laughed. I've been so set on pleasing my mother that finding any joy of my own seemed unreasonable. Not that it mattered. I could be the perfect monster, and it wouldn't change a thing. If I disappoint her, I'm a failure. But if I excel, I prove my worth as a ruler, and that's a far greater sin. I think of what look she'll have when I present the second eye of Keto to her and throw it down like a gauntlet. The scouts let us pass, and when they move aside, the city opens its arms. Nobody takes a second look at me. I blend into the stone, merging with every other face in the market. I'm utterly insignificant for the first time. It's both freeing and maddening. "Take a good look," Elian says. "This could be your new home." His hat hangs at his side, hooked onto the handle of his knife. Concealing the weapon and drawing attention to it all the same. He wants to be noticed. He's incapable of being forgettable. I cross my arms over my chest. "You'd really just leave me here if you don't think I'm useful enough?" "I prefer abandon," he says. "Desert, dump, push heartlessly to the wayside." He sweeps a lock of thick black hair out of his eyes. "You have to admit that Idilio is better than the plank," he says. "Or a cage." At this moment, I think I'd prefer either of them. The feel of land under my feet is strange, and its steadiness tugs my stomach in too many directions. I long for water gushing against my fins, or even the rock and sway of the sod. Everything on land is too still, too permanent. Don't you miss it? I don't know why I'm asking, as though Elian and I have anything in common. I should leave while I can. I should kill him while I can. Forget waiting until he leads me to the eye. Forget trying to overthrow my mother, and just take his heart like she demanded, securing my place as her heir again. If I come back with enough human weapons, surely I can take him on. Instead, I simply say, "The ocean," and Elian's eyes crinkle. "It's still out there," he says. "So far, we've walked for 3 hours. It's never too far. You're forgetting that this whole place is a river delta. There are limits to my Maidasin, and when I stare blankly at the mention of a river delta, Kai releases a loud sigh from a nearby market stall. "Oh, come on." He licks chocolate from his finger. "Don't tell me you're not up on centuplicate geography." "It's how Cardian was made," Madrid explains. Her hair is in two high ponytails now, and when she speaks, she reaches up to tug them tighter. "A river delta formed from Idilio, and cousins of the royal family decided they deserved a nation of their own, so they took it and named themselves king and queen." "My kind of people!" Kai raises his fist in the air like a toast. "Your kind of people aren't anyone's kind of people," Madrid says. "You're uniquely idiotic." "You had me at unique," Kai says, and then turns to me. "All that separates Cardian and Idilio are rivers and estuaries. They're everywhere you look in this place." I remember Tarek's comment on the sod, about how Idilio was Elian's favorite kingdom. At the time, I couldn't fathom why. The rogue prince enamored with a land of love seemed odd at best and ridiculous at worst. But now, understanding dawns. "That's why you like it here," I say to Elian. "Because the ocean is never too far away." He smiles, but just as he is about to respond, Tarek places a hand on his shoulder.
"We got to get moving, Captain. The Serendipity only holds our rooms for 2 hours after sunrise."
"You go," Elian tells him. "I'm right behind you." Tarek gives a swift nod, and when he turns to leave, the rest of the crew follows his lead.
except for Kai, who lingers on the edge of the crowd with an unfathomable expression. He squeezes Madrid's hand just once, and then watches until she disappears. When she's no longer in sight, he turns back to Elian and me, his face adopting a sudden severity. It seems the prince is so rarely left unguarded.
I owe you something, Elian says. Or, technically, you owe me since I saved you from drowning. But I'm not one for holding life debts.
There is a flicker of a smile on his lips as he unloops my seashell from his neck. Something like hope takes a hold of me. My fingers twitch by my side.
Here, he says, and throws it to me.
As soon as the scarlet shell touches my hand, power floods through me. My knees almost give way as I feel an ungodly strength return. My bones harden, my skin crystallizing. For a moment my heart withers back to what it was. Then there's a whisper that slowly turns to a hum. I can hear the call of the Diabolus Sea and the kingdom of Quito. I can hear my home. And then it's gone. Just like my powers. The rush disappears as quickly as it came. My body slackens and my skin turns warm and soft. Bones so easily broken. Heart red and pounding once more. The ocean is silent. Lyra. I snap my eyes up to meet Elian's. I still can't get used to the sound of my name and his accent. Like one of the songs I used to sing. A melody as sweet as it is deadly.
If you miss the ocean, he says, then Rioma Putoder is the closest water you'll find. On the holy day, locals throw stones in the waterfall to wish for their lost love. Access is forbidden the rest of the week, but I don't doubt you'll be able to find a way around that.
He makes to move by me and I sidestep. Wait, I say. I thought you said you wanted me to prove myself worthy of going with you. I told you that I have information on the crystal you're looking for, and now suddenly you won't even consider a deal?
I've made enough deals lately, Elian says, and the last thing I need is a straggler on this mission, especially one I can't trust. Besides, you can't offer me anything I don't already know.
Elian settles his hat back onto his head with a graceful twirl and tips it forward in my direction.
If you go to the Rioma Putoder, he says, try not to drown this time.
He doesn't look at me again before he turns to weave his way through the market and toward Kai. I catch a brief glimpse of them standing together, and then, just like that, they disappear into the crowd. It takes me the better part of an hour to find the Rioma Putoder. I don't ask for help, partly because my pride can't take another human rescuing me. Mostly because my patience can't take another human talking to me. I've already been stopped over a dozen times by locals offering me food and warmer clothing, as though I need it in this sweltering heat. There's something about a girl wandering alone in a wrinkled dress and old pirate boots that unnerves them. I bet ripping out their hearts would be more unnerving. The Rioma Putoder is a waterfall with a pure white lagoon that, somewhere far in the distance, leaks into the ocean. I heard it before I saw it. Lost in the endless bakery alleyways, the smell of pastries clinging to my skin like perfume. It sounded like thunder, and there were a few hesitant seconds when I thought for sure that was what it was. But the closer I got, the more recognizable the sound was. Water so powerful that it sent shudders through me. I sit quietly at the base of the waterfall, my legs hanging over the edge of the lagoon. It's so warm that every now and again I have to take my feet out and let them rest against the dewy grass. At the bottom of the water, sitting on sand that looks akin to snow, there are thousands of red metal coins. They peek out from the shingle like tiny droplets of blood. I thumb the seashell, pressing it to my ear,
brings nothing but unbearable silence. I've been trying ever since Elian left me in the marketplace. On the walk to the waterfall, I held it against me desperately, hoping that with time it would speak to me again. There were a few moments when I almost tricked myself into thinking that I could hear the echo of a wave. The rumble of a sea storm. My mother's bubbling laughter. Really, the only sound was the ringing of my ears. All of that power. Gone. A tease of my own self dangled in front of me just long enough for the thirst to return. I wonder if it's another one of my mother's tricks. Let me keep the shell so she can taunt me with the echoes of my destroyed legacy. I grip it tighter. I want to feel it splinter into my skin, crack and crumble to nothing. But when I open my hand, it's intact, undamaged, and all that remains is an indent in my palm. With a scream, I raise my arm high above my head and throw the shell into the water. It lands with an anticlimactic plop, and then sinks leisurely to the bottom. I can see every moment of its slow descent until it finally settles against the waterbed. Then there is a glow. Faint at first, but it soon scatters into orbs and embers. I inch back. In all the time I've used the seashells to communicate with sirens, or even as a compass to my kingdom, I've rarely seen this. It calls out as though it can sense my desperation, reaching into the waters to search for another of my kind. Instead of a map, it's acting as a beacon. And then, in almost no time at all, Kalia appears. My cousin's blonde hair is swiped across the water, falling into her face so that her eyes fail to meet mine. I jump to my feet. Kalia, I say with astonishment, you're here. She nods and holds out her hand. Resting against her long, spiny fingers is my seashell. She throws it onto the grass by my feet. I heard your call, she says quietly. Do you have the prince's heart yet? I frown as her head stays bowed. What's the matter? I ask. Can't you look at me now? When Kalia does nothing but shake her head, I feel a pang. She once admired me so venomously that it drove my mother to hate her. My entire life, Kalia remained the only one in our kingdom who I thought to care about, and now she can't even look me in the eye. It's not that, Kalia says, like she senses my thoughts. She lifts her head, and there's a tenuous smile on her thin pink lips as she fiddles uncharacteristically with the seaweed bodice around her chest. She takes in my human form, and rather than look scared or disgusted, she only looks curious. She cocks her head, her milk-yellow eyes wide and glistening. But her other eye, the one that matches my own so perfectly, is shut and bruised black. I grip my teeth, grinding bone on bone. What happened? There had to be a punishment, she says. For what? For helping you kill the Adekarosan prince. I take an outraged step forward, feet teetering on the edge of the lagoon. I took that punishment. The brunt of it, Kalia says, which is why I'm still alive. A chill runs through me. I should have known my mother couldn't be satiated with punishing one siren when she could have two. Why make me suffer alone? It's a lesson she's taught me so often before, first with Christelle, and now with her daughter. The Sea Queen is entirely too merciful, I say. Kalia offers me a meek smile. Does the prince still have his heart? She asks. If you bring it back, this will be over. You can come home. The desperate hope in her voice makes me flinch. She's scared to return to the Diavolos Sea without me, because if I'm not there, then nobody will protect her from my mother. When we first met, I was too weak from almost drowning to kill him. Kalia grins. What is he like? She asks.
compared to the others. I consider telling her about Elian's truth-discerning compass and the knife he carries that's as sharp as his gaze, drinking whatever blood it draws. How he smells of anglers and ocean salt. Instead, I say something else altogether. Something she will find far more entertaining. He locked me in a cage. Kalia splutters a laugh. That doesn't sound too princely, she says. Aren't human royals supposed to be accommodating? He has more important things to worry about, I suppose. Like what? Her voice is eager as she swipes a string of seaweed from her arm. Hunting legends, I explain. Kalia shoots me a teasing look. Weren't you one of those? I raise my eyebrows at the jab, pleased to see some of the spark return to her face. He's looking for the second eye of Quito, I say. Kalia swims forward, throwing her arms on the damp grass by my feet. Lyra, she says, you're planning something wicked, aren't you? Do I have to guess? That depends entirely on how much you enjoy playing minion to your beloved aunt. The Sea Queen can't expect devotion if she preaches the opposite, Kalia says. And I know she's thinking of Krestel, the mother who laid down her life for her in an act of devotion my own mother could only scoff at. It doesn't surprise me that Kalia would be eager to turn against the Sea Queen. The only thing that has ever surprised me is her continued allegiance to me, even after what I did, what I was made to do. Somehow Krestel's death bonded us rather than tearing us apart as my mother had hoped it would. I can't help but feel smug at the look of cunning in Kalia's eyes. Expected or not, the display of loyalty is all too satisfying. If the prince leads me to the eye, then the power it holds would make me a match for the Sea Queen. I hold my cousin's gaze. I can stop her from ever daring to touch either of us again. And if you fail? Kalia asks. What becomes of us then? I won't fail, I tell her. All I need to do is share enough of our secrets to get the prince to trust me, and he'll welcome me on board. Kalia looks doubtful. You're weak now, she says. If the prince finds out who you are, then he could kill you like he killed Maeve. You know about that? I ask, though I shouldn't be shocked. The Sea Queen can feel the death of every siren, and now that she's keeping Kalia so close to her side in my absence, no doubt my cousin would have been there when she felt it. Kalia nods. The Sea Queen waved it off as though it were nothing. The hypocrisy of that strikes me. My mother showed more emotion when I killed a lowly mermaid than when one of our own kind was gutted on the deck of a pirate ship. Our deaths are nothing but a minor annoyance to her. I wonder if the real reason she wants to kill the humans is not so much for the good of our kind, but so she can stop experiencing the inconvenience of our deaths. We're expendable in this war. Every last one of us so easily replaced. Even me. Perhaps, especially me. That will change soon, I say. I reach over and place a hand on Kalia's arm, my palm an odd blanket of warmth over the frost of her skin. I'll take the eye and the Sea Queen's throne along with it.
20. Elian. In the palace, it's always hard to tell who's in their right mind. I stand alone in the entrance hall and fasten my black waistcoat. I look princely, which is exactly how I hate to be, and always how Queen Galena wants me. The sun of Idilio has long vanished, and with it the paint-blotted sky has dimmed to midnight hues. Inside the palace, the walls are a soft red, but under the light of so many chandeliers, they look almost orange, like watered-down blood. I try not to reach for my knife. Madness moves at inhuman speed here, and even I'm not quick enough to stop it. I feel unsettled in this place, without my crew beside me. But bringing them would mean breaking a pact between the royal families of the world. Letting them in on a secret that should never be known, especially to pirates. So, instead of bringing my crew, I lie to them. I lie to everyone these days. Whisper stories of how mundane a pirate's life is to my sister. Wink when I tell my crew about Queen Galena and how she likes me all to herself. Only Kai knows otherwise, which is the one favorable aspect to being a diplomat's son that either of us has been able to find. Being aware of royal secrets or having dirt on the world's leaders to use when convenient is something Kai's father specializes in. And Kai, who usually makes it a point to be a paradox to his upper-class bloodline, has kept that trait. It's the only thing he inherited from his father. "Are you sure you don't want me there?" he asked on the way to the Serendipity. I glanced back to see if Lyra was still standing in the center of the market square, but it was far too busy and we were far too fast and she was far too elusive to stay prominent in a crowd. "I need Queen Galena to trust me," I said, "and your being there won't help."
"Why?"
"Because nobody trusts diplomats." Kai nodded as though that was a valid point and shoved his hands into his pockets.
"Still," he said, "it'd be nice for you to have backup in case Galena isn't fond of your plan to manipulate her kingdom."
"Your confidence in me is heartwarming."
"Nothing against your charm," he said, "but do you really think she's going to go for it?"
"Everything you just said is exactly against my charm." I knocked his shoulder with mine. "Either way, it's worth a try. If there's any hope that Queen Galena can help me sidestep a marriage alliance with someone fully capable of killing me in my sleep, then I'll take it."
"You say that like Galena isn't fully capable of killing you when you're awake."
He had a point, of course. Kai always made a habit of having points, especially where dangerous women were concerned. Still, I left him behind with the others because as nice as backup would be, there's not a chance in hell Galena would let a pirate into her palace. I looked down at my shirt to check if my buttons are fastened, just in case. There are certain sins that won't be tolerated. And stand up a little straighter. Comb back my hair with my hand. I already miss my hat and my boots and everything else that keeps the sod with me even when she's docked. But Galena really does hate pirates. She trusts me more when she can see the Prince of Gold rather than a captain of the sea. Though there are a lot of things I will never understand about her, that isn't one of them. I barely trust myself when I've got my hat on.
"She's waiting for you."
A guard steps out from the shadows. He is covered head to toe in red armor, not a single slice of skin on show. His eyes float aimlessly in a sea of red fabric. This is what it's like for most of the guards and household staff. Never any chance of being touched directly. I eye him cautiously. "I was waiting for you," I tell him. "The door looks too heavy to open all by myself." I can't tell if he smiles or glares, but he definitely doesn't blink. After considering me for a mere second, he steps forward and brings his hand to the door. The room is different. Not just from the rest of the palace, but from how it was the last time I was here. The marble walls have turned charcoal and are thick with stale ash and the smell of burning. The ceiling sprawls to endless heights, ribbed by grand wooden beams, and the color is gone from everywhere but the floor. It's the only red thing, polished to shine. And in the far corner, on a throne shaped like a bleeding heart, the Queen of Idilio smiles.
"Hello, Elian."
The guard closes the door and Queen Galena beckons me forward. Her black hair glides down her waist and onto the floor in tight coils. It's woven with rose petals that shed from her like tiny feathers. Her deep brown skin blends into the satin dress that begins at her chin and ends far past her toes. She holds out her hand for mine, fingers spread like a spider web. I consider her for a moment and then raise an eyebrow because she should know better. Or, at least, be aware that I know better. The legend of Adilio says that anyone who touches a member of the royal family will instantly find their soulmate. The secret of Adilio, which only the royal families of the Hundred Kingdoms, and Kai's family apparently, are privy to, is a little different. Because the gift, passed down through the women of the family, does not help men find love, but lose their will completely. Overtaken by endless devotion and lust until they become mindless puppets. I take a seat on the plush sofa opposite the thrones, and Galena drops her hand with a smirk. She leans back and stretches her legs out onto the tiles.
You came to visit, Galena says, which must mean that you want something.
The pleasure of your company. Galena laughs.
Neither of us has pleasurable company.
The pleasure of your company and a mutually beneficial bargain. Galena sits up a little straighter.
A bargain or a favor? I much prefer favors, she says, especially when they place princes in my debt.
Sakura's face flashes across my mind. And I think back to the bargain I made with her. My kingdom for an end to the Siren Plague. I'm in enough debt with royalty, I say.
Spoil sport, Galena teases. I won't ask for much, just a region or two, perhaps a kiss.
Usually I entertain this game of cat and mouse for a little longer. Let her toy with me through thinly veiled threats of skin on skin, as though she would ever dare turn me into one of her playthings. On a normal day, we would pretend, I to be scared she would touch me, and Galena to be brave enough to consider it. But the truth is that for all of her faults, and the last I counted, there were many, Galena takes little joy in her abilities. It even caused the king to turn against her when he grew tired of protecting her secret for a marriage that offered no intimacy. Galena didn't hold his hand or stand close enough for their skin to touch, nor did she share a bed with him on their wedding night or any other night that followed. They slept at distant ends of the palace, in separate wings, with separate servants, and ate very much the same way. At opposite ends of a table large enough to seat 20. It was information we shouldn't have known, but once the king had a drink, he was more than vocal about such matters. Unlike her predecessors, Galena has no desire to force love to secure heirs. She didn't want her husband to slowly lose his mind with devotion, and so, instead, he slowly lost it to greed. He wanted more than she could offer. Her kingdom, if he could. And it resulted in a coup bloodier than most wars. Since his betrayal, she seems to have chosen a life of even more solitude. There is to be no second husband, she told the other ruling families. I've no interest in being betrayed again or passing my curse on to any children. And so, instead, she takes in wards from Orfana, which houses all of the world's unwanted children. Not continuing her bloodline is bad enough, but choosing to rule alone has left her country suffering. With Cardia gaining power, Galena needs someone by her side to do the things her gift prevents her from, like liaise with the people and offer the warmth she has grown too frightened to give. And I need someone who can get me out of my deal with Sakura. I walk toward the throne and hold out a piece of parchment. This time I'm too anxious to play pretend. Galena's reluctance to remarry tells me all I need to know and, in a fortuitous turn of fate, presents a rather interesting solution to one of my many problems. So rarely does karma grant me such favors. Galena takes the parchment from me, and her eyes scan over the paper, first with a confused frown, and then with an intrigued smirk. It's exactly the sort of reaction I was hoping for. "Prince Elian," she says, "how did you get your hands on something like this?" I take a step forward, as close as I can get without risking my sanity. From the same place you can get everything you've ever wanted. Things were going smoothly, or rather, they had screwed themselves into a great mess, and I was getting closer to pressing out the wrinkles. Galena played coy, but there was undeniable thirst in her eyes that gave me hope. "Mutually beneficial," she mused, quoting my words back to me. Her support would mean one less thing to think about on this impossible mission. And with Lyra finally off my ship, I've also got one less person to worry about trusting. All in a day's work. I struggle to get Lyra's face out of my mind as I walk through the sparse Idyllian streets. When I returned the seashell, there had been an odd look in her eyes, like I was idiotic and wonderful at the same time. Like I was a fool, and she was glad for it. I take in a long breath and press my palms to my eyes, trying to blot out the sleep. When she told me that the Sea Queen had taken revenge on her family, it seemed sincere enough. And the compass, though unsteady, had pointed north just the same. Still, I haven't been able to shake the feeling that something isn't right. That no matter what truths she may give, there are lies hidden within. I stroll across the abandoned market street, which is thick with pastry crumbs. The night is warm and sweet, even with the moon blanketing the sky. The stars here are clearer than in most kingdoms, and it's a struggle for me to keep walking, not to stand and marvel at them. Lie on the cobblestone and think about their stories the way I do aboard the Sod. I head toward the Serendipity. We stay there each time we dock in Idyllio because it's an inn and a tavern, and there are few things that can't be solved with both sleep and rum. As I make my way there, a symphony of footsteps trail behind my own. I slow my pace and slip into a nearby alley marked by abandoned trader stools. It's thin, and a line of stars hangs overhead like street lamps. I push myself against the wall, feeling warm brick against my back. The footsteps become uncertain, searching. There's a small moment of trepidation, when the world goes quiet and all I hear is a low gasp of wind. Then, the footsteps follow me into the alley. I don't wait for my attacker to strike. I step out of the darkness, hand poised over my knife, ready to gut whoever would be stupid enough to try to jump the captain of the Sod. A girl stands, half in the shadows, dark red hair clinging to her cheeks. When she sees me, she hooks her hands over her hips, exasperated. Her eyes flood through me like poison. "Why are you hiding?" Lyra asks. "I was trying to follow you." I let out a long breath and sheathe my knife. "I'm pretty sure I got rid of you already." Lyra shrugs, unoffended. And I consider what it would take to get under her skin. She waves off each and every comment like they're barely an annoyance. As though she has far better things to do than worry about what me or any of my crew thinks. Lyra studies me. "Why do you look like a prince all of a sudden?" she asks. "I am a prince," I say, and move to pass her. Lyra walks in stride with me. "Not usually." "What would you know about being usual?" Lyra's face remains blank, and once again I fail to have any sort of impact. Then she rolls her eyes as if in compromise. "Here, I'll act irritated just to please you, Your Highness." "You're right," Lyra tells me. She pulls on the fabric of her dress. It's an old raggedy thing that Madrid found shoved into a trunk below decks. a stowaway from a ransack of a pirate ship. I'm almost sure it was pretty once, just as I'm almost sure we've been using it to clean Madrid's spear gun for the past year. It was the best that I could do on short notice, unless Lyra wanted to be clothed like a pirate, which I doubted. Still, looking at her now, the decent man in me feels a little ashamed. Lyra stops walking to clutch the ends of her dress in both hands, and then lower to the ground in a sardonic curtsy. I, too, stop, shooting her a scathing look, and she scoffs, which is the closest thing to a laugh I've heard from her. Queen Galena isn't big on pirates, I tell her as I turn away and begin walking again. Lyra follows. It's not like I enjoy dressing this way. I tug at my collar, which suddenly feels tight around my neck. There's silence, and Lyra promptly stops walking. I turn to face her, a question in my eyes, but she just stares. Here, she says, and makes a grab for my knife. I flinch back and grab her wrist before she has the chance. Lyra shoots me a disparaging look, like I'm even more of an idiot than she thought. I can feel her pulse strumming under my thumb before she slowly pulls out of my grasp. She reaches for my knife again, tentatively. And this time I let her. I can tell she's enjoying the fact that I'm wary, as though it's the greatest compliment I could give. When her hand touches the knife, there's a spark in my chest, like a cog being pulled loose from a machine. I've always been connected to it in a way that I struggle to explain. When Lyra touches it, I feel a sudden coldness passing from the blade through to my bones. I watch her with steady eyes, not risking a blink. She hesitates with the blade in her hands, as though considering all the possibilities it could bring. And then, she takes a breath and swiftly cuts a line down my shirt sleeve. The blade grazes my skin, but miraculously doesn't draw blood. I snatch the knife back from her. What do you think you're doing? I ask, surveying the tear below my shoulder. Now, you look like a pirate, she says, and continues walking. Incredulous, I jog to catch up with her. I'm about to tell her that she's going to have to pay for that, either with coin, which I doubt she has, or her life. But she turns to me and says, I saw the Rioma Pudota. Did you make a wish? Maybe I stole one instead. She says this with a biting smile, but as the sentence fades, she reaches up to toy with the seashell I returned. It looks unnaturally bright against her neck. She touches it compulsively, and I recognize the gesture. It's something I've done 1,000 times over with my family crest ring. Whenever I think of the people I've left behind, or the burdens of a kingdom I'll never feel ready to rule. If Lyra's story is true, then the necklace probably belonged to the siren who killed her family. Talisman to remind her of the revenge she must carry out. I still want to come with you, Lyra says. I fight to keep walking with long, even strides. The Serendipity appears ahead. Another building in a row of chess piece houses. It's stacked 3 stories higher than the others, with orange brick and a sign that hangs from a silhouette of the love god. Outside, a group of women smoke cigars on thick oak benches, large jugs of mulled wine by their feet. We stop by the doorway, and I raise an eyebrow. To avenge your family? To stop this war, once and for all. We're at war? I make a grab for the door. How dramatic. Lyra snatches my torn shirt sleeve. This needs to end, she says. I flinch at the contact, resisting the urge to go for my knife. There's never a time when I don't have to be on guard. I roll my shoulder out of Lyra's grip and keep my voice low. Don't keep making the mistake of thinking you can touch me, I tell her. I'm the crown prince of Midas and captain of the world's most deadly ship. If you do that again, a few nights in a cage will seem like a godsend. The Sea Queen took everything from me. Lyra spits, ignoring the threat. There's a deep crease in the center of her brow, and when she shakes her head, it's as though she is trying to shake the wrinkle out. You can't imagine the pain she caused. The crystal of Keto is the only way to fix that. She hisses the last part, the raw and scratchy way her voice pounces on the medicine, like the words aren't enough to convey what she's feeling makes my head swim. So much inside of her that she can't get out. Thoughts and feelings there are never enough ways to show. I swallow and try to pull myself together. You said you know things that nobody else does. Like what? Like the ritual you must perform if you want to free the crystal of Keto from where it's hidden, she says. I'd bet my life you don't have the first clue about that. I don't let the surprise register on my face. Even Sakura didn't know the first thing about the ritual we need to conduct, and it's hidden in her kingdom. What are the chances a stowaway on my ship would be the one to have the last piece of my puzzle? There's no way I'm that lucky. You have a habit of using your life as collateral, I say. Does that mean you will take the deal? Lyra asks. I'd be a fool to take it and trust a stranger who claims to know the one secret I don't. I haven't survived this long by putting my life in the hands of my ex-prisoners. But to not take it would make me even more of a fool. Lyra can speak Saren. She has experience hunting sirens. What if I leave her behind and then can't even free the crystal once I have it? If I make it all that way only to drown in the final wave? The ritual is the only part of my quest where I don't have an idea past winging it. And now Lyra is offering up a plan of her own on a gold platter. If Kai were here, he'd tell me not to even think about considering it. Good riddance, he said when we left Lyra to the streets of Idilio. Sure neither of us would see her again. I've got enough to protect you from without adding deadly damsels to the list. And he wasn't wrong. Kai had sworn to protect me, not just to my father, whose money he'd taken more for the heck of it than to seal any deal, but to me, to himself, and Kai has never taken that job lightly. But I have a job too, a mission, and without Lyra's help, I could leave the world open to the evils of the Sea Queen and her race forever. Well, Lyra presses, are you going to take the deal? I told you I don't take deals, I say. But maybe I'll take your word instead. I pull open the door to the Serendipity and Lyra pushes through ahead of me. I'm hit with the familiar smell of metal and ginger root, and there are 1,000 memories that shift through my mind, each as dastardly as the next. For all the ideas a name can give, the Serendipities tells nothing of its true nature. It's a den of gamblers, and the kinds of men and women who never see the light of day. They stick to moonlight, far from the ornate colors of the town. They are shadows, with fingers made sticky by debt, and wine strong enough to knock a person dead from a single jug. Some of my crew takes the large round table at the back, and I smile. When I left to visit Queen Galena and strike a deal for my future, an odd wave of nausea crept up into my stomach, like an ocean sickness, if I could ever feel such a thing. Land sickness, maybe. Being separated from them, especially for such an important task, left me drained. Seeing them now, I'm revitalized. Just so you know, I say to Lyra, if you're lying, I might kill you. Lyra tips her chin up, eyes defiant and too blue for me to look at her straight. At first, I'm not sure if she's going to say anything back, but then she licks her lips, and I know it's because she can taste the sweetness of whatever insult she's about to throw. Maybe, she says as the light whimpers against her skin, I might just kill you first. 21. Elian. Fog pools by the open window like the whirls of cigar smoke. With it comes the smell of dawn as the pink-lipped sky barely stays tucked behind the line of ocean. Time is lost here in a way that can't be said for anywhere else in the kingdom or the world. The serendipity exists in its own realm, with the people who could never truly belong anywhere else. It deals and deals, and caters only to traders who could never set up stalls for their goods. Torek breaks into a low whistle as he deals another hand. His fingers glide over the cards, slick as butter, swiping them across the table in perfect piles by the stacks of red coins. When he's done, Madrid fingers her deck blankly, like the cards themselves don't matter, only what she does with them. Madrid is very good at adapting and never satisfied with playing the hand she's dealt. I'd like to say I taught her that, but there are so many things Madrid was forced to learn before she chose the sod. When you're taken by a Clefdisis slave ship, you quickly learn that to survive, you can't bend to the world. You have to make it bend to you. Unfortunately for Madrid, her tell is the fact that she has no tell. She's never willing to end how she begins, and though that means I can't guess her hand like I can most people's, knowing that she won't settle makes it easy to guess what she's going to do next. Lyra watches us predatorily, her eyes darting each time a hand moves or a coin falls from the top of a pile. I can tell that she sees the same things I do. Whenever someone scratches their cheek or swallows a little too forcefully, minute beads of sweat and twitching lips, the intonation when they ask for another jug of wine. She notices it all. Not only that, but she's making notes of it, filing their tells and ticks away for whatever reason. Keeping them safe, maybe, to use again. When Kai shifts a row of red coins into the center table, I watch Lyra. She quirks her lips a little to the right. And even though she can't see his cards, there's no possible way she could. She knows his hand. And she knows he's bluffing. Lyra catches my eye, and when she sees me staring, her smile fades. I'm angry at myself for that. I never seem quick enough when it comes to watching these moments for long enough to pick them apart and see how she works. Why she works. What angle she's working. I push my coins into the center of the table. It's too quiet in here, Madrid says. She grabs the wine decanter from the table and fills her glass a little higher until red sloshes over the brim. If Madrid is a good shooter, she's an even better drinker. In all our years together, I've never so much as seen her lose balance after a night of heavy liquor. Madrid sips the wine carefully, savoring the vintage in a way none of us have ever thought to. It reminds me of the wine-tasting lessons my father forced me to attend as part of my royal training. Because nothing says King of Midas like knowing a fine wine from something distilled in a back-alley tavern.
Sing Shore of the Tides,
Torek suggests dryly.
Maybe it'll drown out the sunlight.
If we're voting, Little Rum Diddy will do, really, anything with rum.
You don't get a vote, Madrid tells Kai, then quirks an eyebrow at me. Cap? I shrug.
Sing whatever you want. Nothing will drown out the sound of me winning.
Madrid pokes her tongue out.
Lyra? She asks. What do they sing where you're from?
For some reason, Lyra finds this amusing.
Nothing you would appreciate.
Madrid nods, as though it's more a fact than an insult.
Siren down below,
she says, looking at Kai with a reluctant smile.
It's got rum in it.
Suits me, then.
Madrid throws herself back onto her chair. Her voice comes out in a loud refrain, words twisting and falling in her native Clefdisis. There's something whimsical to the way she sings. And whether it's the tune or the endearing grin drawn on Kai's face as she bellows the melody,
I can't help but tap my fingers against my knee in rhythm to her voice. Around the table, the crew follows on. They hum and murmur the parts they can't remember, roaring out each mention of rum. Their voices dance into one another, colliding clumsily through verses. Each of them sings in the language of their kingdom. It brings a piece of their homes to this misshapen crew, reminding me of a time so long ago when we weren't together. When we were more strangers than family, belonging nowhere we traveled and never having the means to go somewhere we might. When they've sung through three choruses, I almost expect Lyra to join in with a rendition from Polymystis. But she remains tight-lipped and curious. She eyes them with a tiny knot in her brow, as though she can't quite understand the ritual. I lean toward her and keep my voice to a whisper. When are you going to sing something? She pushes me away. Don't get too close, she says. You absolutely stink. Of what? Anglers, she says. That oil they put on their hands and those stupid sweets they chew. Licorice, I tell her with a smirk. And you didn't answer my question. Are you ever going to grace us with your voice? Believe me, I'd like nothing more. I settle back in my chair and open my arms. Whenever you're ready. I'm ready for you to tell me everything you know about the Crystal of Quito. It always comes back to that. We've been in Idilio for 2 days, and Lyra has been relentless in her questions, always wanting answers without ever revealing any herself. Someone, of course, has to go first, and I'll admit that I've grown bored waiting for it to be her. All I know is that it's in Pagos, I tell her, wary of the glares Kai is sending my way. If it were up to him, the only way Lyra would come aboard the Sod is if she were back in the cage. It's at the top of the Cloud Mountain, I explain, in a sacred ice palace. You have a great ability to disguise knowing a lot as knowing a little. And you have a great ability to disguise knowing nothing as knowing everything, I tell her. You still haven't told me about the ritual. If I tell you, then there's no use in you keeping me around, and I'm not going to spill the best leverage I have so you can leave me stranded here. She has a point. The best habit I have is keeping only what I can use, and Lyra is definitely something I can use. Even thinking it makes me sound too pirate-like for my own good. And I imagine my father's crude disappointment at how I've come to regard people as a means to an end. Bargaining chips I trade like coin. But Lyra is in the unique position of knowing what she is, and of being more than happy to play along if it gets her what she wants. Tell me something else, then. I swap a card from the deck. What do you know about the crystal? For starters, she says, chastising. It isn't a crystal. It's an eye. The ruby eye of the great sea goddess, taken from the sirens so their new queen and her predecessors would never be able to hold the power that Quito did. Tell me something I don't know. Okay, she says like it's a challenge I've thrown down. The sea queen's trident is made from Quito's bones. And Quito's second eye is what powers it. When the goddess was killed, her most loyal child was nearby. She couldn't prevent Quito's death, but she did manage to steal one of her eyes before the humans could take both. With that and the few pieces of Quito that remained, she fashioned the trident and became the first sea queen. That trident has been passed down from generation to the eldest daughter of every sea queen. They use it to control the ocean and all of its creatures. As long as the queen has it, every monster in the sea is hers. And if she finds the other eye, she'll use it to enslave humans in the same way. What a thrilling story.
Kai stares at his deck. Did you make that one up on